Good morning. Hi. So we just chanted to remember and become. That's pretty good, isn't it? To remember and become. When we become something, then we don't have to remember anymore because we are it. And that's really what Zen practice and Zen life is about. This morning I'm going to talk about three stories about Zen Master Joshu, or Zhao Zhou, if you want to be correct. Japanese have called him Joshu for hundreds of years, and my teachers were Japanese, so I'm going to use Joshu, but it's actually Zhao Zhou, right? And if someone who was Chinese were here, they'd probably correct my pronunciation. Three stories. Joshu was Suzuki Roshi's favorite Chinese Zen teacher, and I don't know why. All I remember Suzuki Roshi saying was that he could touch his nose with his tongue. You know, I guess that's what he had become, adept at touching his nose with his tongue. Joshu Zen master, we know quite a bit about him. A lot's been written about him. He lived in the 9th century. He started practicing when he was 18 and practiced until he was 119 and died, supposedly. But actually, there's a lot of stuff written about him. So he probably did, although we don't know what his practice was like at 118. It's probably just getting out of bed and going back to bed or something. With great mindfulness, right? Great composure. So he's featured in the collections of Zen stories, of Chan stories. He's featured in The Gateless Barrier. And he's featured in the Blue Cliff Records, among others. That's probably all you need to know about him for now. So the story that he's known best for is just the very simple little interchange, which becomes so important in the history of Zen. And I think the reason it becomes so important is it's the first case in the gateless barrier. So teachers look at it first, students look at it first, and nobody ever gets beyond it to the other ones. And it is what? It is someone approached Joshu, someone approached Zhao Zhou, and they said, welcome.
Hi.
They said, does the dog have Buddha nature? And Joshu answered, mu or wu in Chinese. Mu or wu, which means nothing, no thing, no. Those are the three meanings, as far as I can tell. No thing, nothing, no. So here's my own version of this story, which you can take or leave. And that is that dogs, in China, people eat dogs. In China, dogs are the lowest of the low. At least China. We had a Chinese guy living with us for a year as our cook. He had a different attitude towards our dogs and our cats. Totally different attitude. You eat dogs. Dogs are the lowest of the low. And so asking the dog, does the dog have Buddha nature, is asking this lowest sort of scurrilous, sort of smelly being that's out there have Buddha nature. But it also could be that the student was feeling kind of like a dog himself in his practice. He was feeling like, God, this is just not working. This is just, I am just messing this up. I'm keeping the schedule, but I'm just going through the motions, or maybe I'm not even keeping the schedule. Of course, if he's in a monastic setting, he doesn't have any choice because the schedule's being kept for him. But if he's in a non-monastic setting, maybe he's not even doing his zazen, or maybe his zazen is just agitated zazen continually. So he's thinking, do I have Buddha nature? Do I have? Because the teaching is, he's gone to Buddhist catechism, right? Which starts when kids are young, and used to start in China and still in Japan when kids are young. Everybody has the Buddha nature. All beings have the Buddha nature. And so the answer is no thing. No. So there are lots of things you can say about this answer. One is you can say what I was saying in my last talk, that the teacher just changed symbol systems. Because the whole point of talking about Buddhism, about Zen, is to go beyond our symbol systems to something immense, something minuscule and yet omnipresent. And you can't capture it with your symbol systems. And you get caught on your symbol systems. So these Zen teachers always change in symbol systems spontaneously and joyfully, and I don't think very methodically. If you look through it, it doesn't seem very methodical. But you could say that he was changing from the symbol system of everything has Buddha nature, which I talked about last time, to the symbol system of shunyata. Everything is empty. Buddha nature. How could there be such a thing as Buddha nature? Just something made up. Everything is empty. But then that's just a symbol system too. But it's something that's harder to get your teeth into. That's why I've talked before about my Meister Eckhart, and I've been reading more about him again. As long as he said everybody has the God within, as long as he said everybody has the God nature, he didn't get in trouble. And he had lots of people coming to get support from him, and through their prayer, how they could do that. But as soon as he said what? As soon as he said in the Godhead, there is no trace of God. Complete emptiness, as Bodhidharma would say, as Joshi would say. You got in a lot of trouble. Because in that time in the Catholic Church, it was not so good to change symbol systems. I'm not going to comment on the present day because I don't want to. I won't get into that. And yet he thought he needed to say that because he wanted to help people go beyond to the stillness that's beyond all symbols, and yet always right here. And then, of course, when Dogen starts talking about Buddha nature and all his things, he starts about, in all his fascicles, all this, he starts talking about you have the Buddha nature, but how can you have it? How can you have it? And then you are the Buddha nature, but there's no Buddha nature that you are, et cetera, et cetera. It's in kind of playful way, but if you try to understand it, you get a headache, especially if you try to teach it. That's why I don't teach it very much. Maybe someday. And so this first story then becomes the kind of foundation of Chinese Rinzai Zen as it develops. And so everybody who studies Linji Zen in China, Linji Chan, is given this story first. Does the dog have Buddha nature? And they're told to just think about it. And of course, most of the commentaries just forget about the dog. Just eliminate the dog and go back to the Buddha nature. And specifically the mu, the no thing, the nothing. So the teachers seem to then, over the hundreds of years, forget about the dog and just say, focus on nothing, on no thing. Focus on mu. Think that deeply. What is that? What is that? Until you can explode your symbol systems. Until you explode with your symbol systems. So thinking deeply. Often we think in Buddhism is not about thinking, but actually it is. We have to think deeply. We have to consider our lives. And in this Rinzai you'll be given something to think on. In Soto, in this school of Zen, we don't given anything particular to think on. But we have lots of thoughts coming through, so there's plenty of material. We don't need something extra. There are plenty of barriers. There are plenty of gateless barriers that come into our thinking always. And we can think on them, and then to use Hermann Hesse's little rendition of Siddhartha, we can think on them, we can wait, and we can fast. We can think, we can wait, we can fast. And that's, if you do that, you'll get some taste of something beyond simple systems, beyond simple, beyond word. And for us, Rinzai, you're thinking on this no thing. That's good. You can do that. But in Soto, it's like whatever thought comes through, there it is. There it is. Can you recognize it? Can you see the desire there? Can you see the energy of it? Can you see the longing of it? Can you recognize it? And then can you restrain it? Can you restrain it? Actually, if you sit in a retreat here, you have to do a lot of restraining. We're having one coming up. It's an easy one, you guys. So come join me. It's one where we start late. Like, what time do we start? 7 or 8 in the morning? 8? Oh, 8. Hey. And we get out at 4 or 5 or something. So try it. Try it. So thinking involves recognizing, seeing it. There it comes through. And then restraining. And then relaxing into it. If we just restrain it and don't relax into it, we're not really thinking deeply. It's not really going beyond. There's no chance of going beyond this symbol if we don't relax into the whatever it is. So we don't need some special koan. We have the koan that comes into our head right now. We always have one. To recognize. Without judging, to restrain, and to relax. And doing this over a long time, it's mind fasting. It's the fasting of the mind. Now, it takes a lot of patience. And in Zen Buddhism, we don't emphasize any other kinds of fasting except mind fasting. We think mind fasting is the key. Just means we don't continually put garbage into our mind. We just sometimes are just with our mind, with nothing else. Just fasting. Because that's the way that we can begin to see something deeper. Something more omnipresent. And if you study Rinzai Zen, you can have a special koan. But if you come in here, you'll have plenty of koans. Koan just means a barrier. A child that comes into your mind. A barrier. So, thinking, waiting, and fasting. And Buddha did it supposedly for 6 years, and Bodhidharma did it for 9 years. And I've been trying to do it for 40-some years. And good luck. Good luck. But after a while, it's possible that just as in a fast from food, for a while the pollutants keep coming in. They keep coming in. But then, at some point, the pollutants are all cleaned out. It happens to all of us because we all have the Buddha nature. Uh-oh. I just used that symbol system, which you might believe in. We all have it. Even though it's not anything. So that's the first story. Second story was when Joshua was a student of non-sen or non-kwan. Again, I'll use the word that I know from my years of practice and study. Nansen. He was Nansen student. He became Nansen student at 18. And this story takes place when he's in his 20s. And we can just assume that he's having a hard time with his practice. Now, why can I assume that? Because it happens to everybody if you take this seriously. If you engage in what I was calling last week serious moments, you will have a hard time at some point or other. You will have a hard time. So let's say that he was having a hard time, and maybe he was embarrassed about it. I'm just making this up, but we don't know. Maybe he was embarrassed, maybe he was upset, maybe he was discouraged. Who knows? So he came to get some support. This is what a Zen teacher wants to do, is give support. And you know, lots of times, I've said this before, and I say it again, people come to me and see me once or twice or three times, and I give them some suggestion, and then they're too embarrassed to come back. Because I think, oh, you know, I didn't do it, I didn't follow through. But what's the point of having a Zen teacher if you just come and show them your good stuff? Because I'm here to help you deal with that gateless barrier and actually recognize that gateless barrier. Recognize it. Restrain yourself from having to trying to blow up the gateless barrier. Sorry you can't from going around it. Sorry you can't from going up over it. Sorry you can't from going. But just to be there with it. Just to recognize it. Just to restrain yourself. And just to relax. And when you relax, it's completely transparent. Transparency is life. It's transparent because it's interdependent. And that's something you can read about it if you want, but I don't care about that. I hope you're not too interested in reading about it. It's much more interesting to actually do it. Although it's frustrating. It's frustrating. So, he comes to see Nansen, and he's, let's say, be embarrassed, I don't know, and he says he wants some support. So he says, what is the way? And, of course, the Chinese Zen teachers in these books never give very helpful support. Well, I don't know. It's a different culture from ours. I mean, they give helpful, but it doesn't seem helpful. Interesting. So, Nansen says, ordinary mind is the way. Ordinary mind is the way. In other words, the mind that gets embarrassed, the mind that gets frustrated, the mind that gets discouraged, the mind that's elated when it has some great awakening, the mind that misses the awakening it should have had or had before, that's the ordinary mind. That's the way. It's very simple. Very, very simple. And so, Joshu says, should I turn toward it or not? Well, if it's ordinary mind, here, teacher, I've been thinking I should be concentrating, focusing, trying to be spacious, and it's just ordinary mind that's the way? Well, should I even turn toward it or not? And the teacher says, if you turn toward it, you turn away from it. Sounds like some mysterious Zen piece of wisdom, doesn't it? If you turn toward it, you turn away from it. So, when we turn toward something, when we turn toward something with the intention of expressing it, merging with it. Often then we're caught by that thing that we turn toward. If we turn toward the barrier instead of seeing the barrier just as it is, if we turn toward it, it catches us. And if we turn toward our emotions, you know, sometimes we're caught by our emotion. In the old days, I've been a human service professional for a long time. In the old days, we used to teach about, especially in Gestalt therapy, which I was not my main thing, but I did a little bit of it. We used to turn toward your anger. Turn toward your anger. If you turn toward your anger, you can cathart it. And so over there on 31st and Hennepin, there was the Gestalt Center in the old days. And we had Zen classes on one floor. On another floor, they were upstairs beating pillows, catharting their anger. We were trying to sit. That was Shokin Wankoff who was doing that, beating on those pillows. Do you remember that, Susan? But it's really common knowledge now that if you try to cathart your anger, usually you're just going to increase your anger. You can cathart it for a little while, but there's been a lot of research on this the last 10 years. And so if you turn towards something, especially if you turn toward it with this idea that you're going to get something, that you're going to release something, you're missing what's here already. You're not mind fasting anymore. To say you're indulging, I don't know. We were never trying to indulge. We were trying to, whatever. Cathart, I guess, is the word I can think of. So should I turn toward it or not? If you turn toward it, you turn away from it. And he says, how can I know the way if I don't turn toward it? And the Zen teacher says, Nansen says, the way is not about knowing or not knowing. When you know something, you are deluded. And when you don't, you are just empty-headed. When you reach the way beyond doubt, it is as vast and infinite as space. You can't say it's right or wrong. And supposedly at that time, Joshu had an awakening. Just saw exactly what this teacher was saying. Exactly what he was saying. Beyond the symbol system to the reality of just being. And supposedly from that time on, Joshu wasn't in a hurry. I don't know if that's true, but that's what the book says. He wasn't in a hurry. And he so wasn't in a hurry that even though this happened in his 20s, he stayed with the teacher Nansen till his teacher died when Joshu was 60 years old. Joshua had never taught. He just stayed with his teacher. We Americans don't know about that. Especially I don't know about that. But it's kind of wonderful. He just stayed with him. He just lived with him. From his 20s till he was 60. His teacher died when he was 60 and said, oh, you're the man now, Joshua. So Joshua then took over. He traveled around and took over, but he didn't take over a temple till he was 80. And then he taught till he was 119. This is fairly well documented. So, Joshu learned how. He learned how. We can all learn how to think, to wait, and to fast. It's not our culture is not set up this way. But are any human cultures set up this way? I don't know. So it's counterculture to do this. But forget about the 60s counterculture. It's counterculture to do this. To think deeply, really deeply on one thing, instead of developing a lot of concepts. Not Descartes' thinking, where Rodin's Descartes. Poor Descartes. You know, Descartes bent over. His thoughts are all over the place. If you see him. Oh, you want to give him a hug. I want to give him a hug. Or a back rub or something. Not that, because he's trying to think about so many things. He's trying to incorporate so many things, figure so many things out. Instead of just recognizing the thought when it comes up, just recognizing, just restraining it, and then relaxing. Suzuki Roshi, my first teacher, as many of you know, he had anger issues. And people don't think, oh, this great Suzuki Roshi teacher. But he had anger issues from the time he was young. He tantrums, right? Well, by the time he came to the United States in his late 50s, he'd done enough of this thinking, waiting, and mind fasting, that his anger didn't come up in this reactive way too often. But sometimes it did. A few times it did. But we just thought he was a great teacher, because we didn't know him. We were sort of in awe of him. But then later, when I read about his anger issues, I thought, oh, that's the deal. This great teaching was his own reactivity to these hippie students who didn't sit still for more than 2 minutes at a time unless they were smoking dope. So through this practice, we learn to not to be so reactive. It just happens. It just happens. So that we can respond more. We have the term call and respond. We can respond instead of react. And then, as it says in one of the things we chant, the lid fits the container. Just fits. The call and the response. But it takes a while. So even Suzuki Roshi, when he's with him and he's 62, he still has a couple of tantrums. But I just think it's some wonderful teaching. Well, it is a wonderful teaching, I guess. What isn't a wonderful teaching? Everything is. So the last story, third story, which I've told before, this is when Joshi was very old. Ancient. But again, we don't know how. We know he's more than 80 and less than 119. And we know he's more than 80 because when he's 60 to 80, he does his traveling. And when he's 80, he sits down, he settles down at Zhaozhou, in the district of Zhaozhou, in the district of Joshu. That's so he's called Joshu later. At 80, he sits down there and his students come there. So he's between 80 and 119. And the district of Zhaozhou becomes known for the teacher, Joshu, because he becomes very well known, but also for the stone bridge of Joshu, the stone bridge that exists in that district, and which Joshu lives by. In some kind of a monastic setting, but we don't exactly know what. And so the stone bridge becomes very famous. And it's considered aesthetically wonderful and spiritually cleansing to go see the stone bridge. So a Zen student, goes to see, makes a journey to meet famous Zen master Joshu and see this stone bridge. And it's a very short interchange, as all these are. The student comes. He finds the place where Joshu is, in some little hut, unshaven, without any robes on, something like this. And he looks for the bridge. He doesn't see anything to speak of. He just sees the stream, and he sees a bunch of stepping stones. And his first thing he says to Joshu is, I only see stepping stones. I don't see the stone bridge. And that's the first thing he says. So he's come all this way, he's disappointed, and all he sees is these stepping stones. So he reacts. He reacts. He's reactive. He doesn't recognize his own reactivity. He doesn't restrain. He doesn't relax. If he relaxed, he would see that those stones, the way those stones go across that creek, are beautiful, that they're artful, and that they're done in just the way that lots of that human beings and animals and everyone can come across. But he's got his expectation. He's got his expectation. He's finally going to do it. He's finally going to see the man, right? And practice. And then he sees the man, and the man is just some old fool, and there's a bunch of rocks in the river. So he reacts. He reacts. And he's, we can say, oh, he's honest, open. Okay, we can say he's honest, open. We are when we react honest, open. But, you know, it's sometimes get not very deep, that honest, open. Just then the other person reacts, da-da-da-da-da, on and on and on. Then the relationship goes south. So, and then Joshi responds. And some of you probably remember how Joshi responds. Joshi says, you only see stepping stones. You don't see the stone bridge. That's the response. You only see stepping stones. You don't see the stone bridge. So Joshi responds from emptiness, from stillness. Or maybe he's just so good at practicing, recognizing, restraining, and relaxing, that he recognizes he's pissed. He restrains himself. He relaxes into it. Then he can just respond. He can just respond. We don't know. I always used to teach the first one, that he's just in emptiness. But then after being a teacher for a few years, I'm starting to teach this a little differently. Noticing my own reactivity, right? Noticing my own reactivity. So, then the student says, well, what is a stone bridge? What is a stone bridge? Pretty frustrated by now with this old guy, right? Who doesn't even have robes on. I did read that Joshi seldom wore his robes when he was down by the river. People didn't know who he was. Incognito. What is a stone bridge? And Joshi says, anybody remember what Joshi says? Nobody remembers. He says, it lets horses cross over, it lets donkeys cross over. That's the end of the interchange. It lets horses cross over, it lets donkeys cross over. That's your innate magnanimity. Innately, we're magnanimous, we're generous, innately. When we let go of our symbol systems and just come back to this practice of mind fasting, we discover our generosity. Our generosity allows the anger to come through, the donkey to come through, the beautiful horse to come through, the beautiful enlightenment to come through. Just recognizes those. Just restrains them gently and relaxes with them. And then we can help ourselves and help others. It's a pretty simple practice. But it takes a while. It takes a while. By this time, Joshi was, as I said, at least 80. I don't want to discourage you, but I can't help it. So that's my story for today. I'll be glad to entertain questions or comments.
So I'm working very hard with my daughter right now because it's all about I can react to her behavior, good or bad, or I can listen.
Well. And how's it going?
Pretty well yesterday.
Pretty well until yesterday, you said?
No, yesterday was good. You know, every day. And of course, when I have an anger problem and I'm fascinated with the Dalai Lama also has tantrums and anger issues. Reacting and let my anger out come out my daughter is the worst, and it seems to like erase any good intentions you have, generosity, or anything, just a single flash. But try not to obsess on that and just start new.
Good. Good for you. What else this morning? This restraint should be very, very simple. I don't talk about restraint very much because I find so many people are just beating themselves up all the time. And I don't want to, I don't want to add to that. But restraint is very simple in that you just, the power, when these emotions come through with our thinking, they're pretty powerful. And restraining just means not immediately acting on it, not immediately doing something, but really feeling it, which is why restraint leads to relaxation, because we're restraining by being with it, not by being against it, not by repressing it, but not by saying, I did this yesterday and it's worse than it was the day before. That's not restraint. That's going on to more Cartesian thinking, more da 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 da. This restraint is just to be with it. Just to be with it. It's your mu, it's your con. So you're restraining it so you can look at it. If you don't restrain something like that, you can't really look at it. You can't really see it. Because already you've just blown it out of proportion. Does that make sense?
Does it work to say that you can be compassionate with yourself and your restraint?
Does that work for you?
Yeah.
Good. Of course. What she says is right, isn't it? We need to be compassionate with ourselves and our restraint. If we're not, it's just turned into a super ego thing, right? Remember super ego? I don't know what we call super ego these days. But there's something else that we call it. The internal parent, I guess we call it now, right? It's just the internal parent. Well, maybe that's old too. There must be some newer thing we call it, right? Yeah, and then we just recognize, oh, that's the internal parent. But we recognize, we relax into it. We have the capacity to relax into it if we really see it, if we're really still with it. And then something else comes up. That's why I say wait and fast. Because the problem is that any of us know of practice meditation, is that it seems like this mind fasting just gives more and more pollutants all the time. But it's the same true for body fasting. It takes a while. You have to keep at it before the pollutants are cleansed. And are they ever 100% cleansed? Apparently not. On the one hand. On the other hand, there is a sense of complete stillness. There is a sense of no separation, which develops when you completely let it clear out, let the pollutants clear out. Yeah, Adam.
I'm so glad that you started with the dogs for
today. Oh, yeah, why?
Well, because I don't have any children at home, and so my dog is my child. And I project all my, wanting to have a child and being connected to him that way.
Yeah.
Cultural spin on it.
Right.
But knowing this dog and living with this dog and being with this dog for almost 4 years now, I feel like I know two things really fairly clearly that seem very subtle. One is that I absolutely have to do it. There's no doubt in my mind. There's no doubt at all. And then the second thing that I'm absolutely sure of is that whether he has Buddha nature or not is absolutely irrelevant to him. He can care less. He's
That's good.
And
he's
my teacher.
Oh, I see. So,
so. It's totally wrong.
Uh-huh. Okay. Okay, well, thank you.